This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network with a recording of a long-awaited event in Central Virginia history, the unveiling of the Free Speech Monument on the Charlottesville Downtown Mall. This download contains the entire program held before the unveiling of the community chalkboard and podium, followed by a montage of what the first group of people wrote on the 42-foot-long slate wall. The monument was built and paid for by the Thomas Jefferson Center for Free Expression and was unveiled on the bright spring morning of April 20th, 2006. Center Director Robert O'Neill began the program.
Good morning. I'm Bob O'Neill, Director of the Thomas Jefferson Center. Delighted to welcome you all to this very festive event. This is obviously a proud day for the center, also a proud day for the city of Charlottesville. Indeed, I have the feeling that our three eminent founding fathers, who always looked down upon this site, must be looking this morning with a special sense of pride about the monument that is soon to be dedicated at the heart of their community. We have a very busy schedule this morning and should get to it at once. In a moment, it will be my special pleasure to turn the podium over to the chairman of our Board of Trustees, Mr. Bruce Sanford of the Washington firm of Baker & Hostetler. He has served remarkably in this capacity since the very day the center opened its doors nearly 16 years ago. He's guided every program, project, or initiative that the center has ever undertaken. Not only have he and Mrs. Sanford, who happily is also with us today, contributed personally and generously to center activities, including the chalkboard, he has also recruited a number of our trustees over the years, but most important, I think, he has wisely, sensitively, and patiently guided us through every step, first of the formative period, and then the nurturing stages of the center's evolution. We do recognize that chairing our Board of Trustees is not Mr. Sanford's day job. That, happily, is serving as the universally acclaimed dean of the Media and Publishing Bar in the District of Columbia. He's also shared his thoughts widely, most recently through a book that has the wonderful title, Don't Shoot the Messenger. Before turning the program over to Mr. Sanford, let me add a personal acknowledgement that none of what we are observing and enjoying today could have happened without the tireless, creative, and energetic dedication of the Center's Associate Director, Josh Wheeler, who conceived the vision for such a monument and, through a long and challenging period, brought it to completion. Nor could it happen without the persistent, wise, and steady devotion of our colleague at the center, Amy McClung. So, in turning the podium over to Mr. Sanford, let me ask that you join us in thanking Josh and Amy for their special roles in this day.
Thank you. It is a special pleasure for me, despite what Bob says, a simple country lawyer from Connecticut Avenue in Washington, to be here on this glorious Charlottesville Day. I'm happy to be the band leader here at the dedication of the Thomas Jefferson Center's chalkboard, or maybe we should just use the more formal terminology and recognize it as Charlottesville's First Amendment Monument. In this age when communication is increasingly digital, and messages and images are more and more virtual, there's something very comforting about having an old-fashioned physical board on which people can express and share their views. And it seems especially fitting that such a physical site should emerge right here in Charlottesville under the eyes of our three eminent founding fathers through happy collaboration between the city and the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression. The idea for the chalkboard was born in Josh Wheeler's brain nearly a decade ago, and it has been all that time in becoming a reality. From this day on, any person in this community who has something to say and wants to put his or her thoughts in tangible form will have a unique place at which to do so. And any other person who disagrees with what's been said has a ready remedy, either making a counterstatement on the chalkboard or erasing what's there. We have absolutely no idea what thoughts and ideas may emerge here, although we do have an acute sense that Mr. Jefferson and Mr. Madison and Mr. Monroe would have applauded both the choice of the site and the very concept. We have some wonderful speakers this morning. When the proposal for this monument was approved by Charlottesville City Council in 2001, the Boston Globe ran an editorial that read, "The idea is gutsy, scary, and fascinating. Not many cities would have the nerve, but Charlottesville, Virginia, deep in Thomas Jefferson country, decided to honor its civic patron with a living memorial to his ideals." It gives me great pleasure this morning to introduce you to the mayor of the city of Charlottesville, a mayor who is gutsy and fascinating and not really very scary, Charlottesville Mayor David Brown.
That was very kind. Thank you. Well, on behalf of the city of Charlottesville, I'd like to welcome everyone here today, and I'd like to thank Mr. Sanford, Mr. O'Neill, Mr. Wheeler, and everyone else at the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression for bringing this monument of national and international significance to our downtown mall. On behalf of the larger Charlottesville community, I'd like to thank you for recognizing the role that our community has played and for honoring the contributions of Thomas Jefferson to all of our freedoms by locating this monument here. But I also want to extend my personal thanks. As my sons move into adulthood and I think about their future, I worry about the steady erosion of freedoms that I have always taken for granted. Some of these freedoms we seem to give up willingly. We allow databases of personal information of our buying habits to be built in exchange for a saving card at Harris Teeter or to gain frequent flyer miles with our Visa. And we allow databases of our travel habits to be created in exchange for the convenience of EasyPass. Some freedoms we give up less willingly, as private information is collected every time we visit the hospital or as we submit to searches of our belongings in order to travel. And some freedoms are simply being taken away from us through the Patriot Act, through the prosecution and jailing of members of the press, or more recently through unauthorized wiretaps. But I believe that this monument will serve as a visible reminder of not just this basic freedom, but of all the freedoms we hold dear. And for this, again, I thank you.
Thank you, David. Whether it's novels or short stories, fiction or nonfiction, history or literary criticism, movie screenplays or poetry, our next speaker has enjoyed the critical acclaim of peers and readers alike. Here today to share just some of his tremendous literary talent, the past poet laureate of Virginia and Charlottesville resident, Mr. George Garrett.
Thank you. This will be brief. Four short things I'm going to read, two of which are advanced as possible mottos for the future, or at least news from the poetry community, and two of which are examples of things that might get written on the board. First thing, from Dr. William Carlos Williams, a great American poet, and just a couple of lines. "It is difficult to get the news from poems, yet men die miserably every day for the lack found there. That is the absence of something. We, by poems, he meant truth and the freedom to search it out. The other goes back about 400 and some years. It's a short Latin poem translated into English by Sir Thomas More, whom you all will remember was the Lord Chancellor under Henry VIII, which was a hot spot to be in. "When our prince is true and good, he is the dog that guards the flock. But when he falls, he turns into a wolf who takes us for his food. Sir Thomas More got his head cut off, not for that poem, but it didn't help a lot. Got his head cut off and was changed. His title changed to Saint Thomas More. And what I thought was, I was looking around for something I had written that had sort of this in mind, but not as clearly as it has come to be. And I realized that possibly there wouldn't be anything quite like this on the program. So I thought I'd read a couple of what I call attack poems, where we attack other people who bother us. Here, for example, these are both very literary, but bear with it. Just a couple. Book review. I am using your pages to start wet kindling wood. Amazing. Such pale poems can make a bright fire. Just about fit. To a certain critic. Here, it doesn't have to be literary critics. We're all criticized every day, every way. It gives me some comfort from time to time to think of this one. To a certain critic. Walking in the woods, you turn over a rotten log, and out from under crawls something very snot-like and pale. If it could open its mouth and talk good English, you'd know exactly what you sound like to me. Finish up with one which is true and came into my mind again recently when the Pope died and we had a new Pope. This goes back to 1958. It's called an Italian Lesson. And it ends with a little motto that I would fit perfectly in one of these things. Whenever I hear of the death of a major poet these days, I remember Rome, 1958. Myself standing alongside an enormous priest by a newspaper kiosk in Trastevere. Il Papa è morto, the Pope is dead, the headlines blared. As the priest turned away, a voice from the crowd, all of them too poor to buy a paper, called out, "Is it true the Holy Father is dead?" The priest nods, then shrugs hugely, and answers them in the local dialect, "Better him than us, huh?" "Better him than us," and walks off to his chores among the poor who are always with us, even to the end of the world. Thank you.
That was terrific, George. Thank you. Can there be a person in the audience who's not read one of John Grisham's wonderful books about justice or seen a movie adapted from his imagination? His gifts as a writer are only surpassed by his civic-mindedness and his generosity. John and his wife, Renee, are helping to meet the needs of the Gulf Coast from the devastating effects of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita through the establishment of the Rebuild the Coast Fund. Ladies and gentlemen, the first citizen of Charlottesville, your neighbor, John Grisham.
Thank you, Bruce. I'd like to apologize. I think I'm going to be the only male speaker today who's not wearing a necktie. And when I got dressed just a few moments ago, I actually thought about wearing one, which I rarely do. And I spent some time looking at the few that I own, and I sort of had one picked out. And then I thought, no, Boyd Tinsley's going to be there. And Boyd is way too cool for a necktie. So in a few moments, you'll see Boyd with a beautiful necktie on. I'm the only one wearing without one. Oriana Fallaci is a well-known Italian journalist and author. She's published about 15 books. She is currently living in New York City, and she's living there because she can't go back to Italy. She cannot go back to Italy because if she goes back, she'll be arrested. Her crime is that a few years ago, she published a book that was critical of the Islamic religion. And that can be a crime in Italy. and in many other free and democratic countries. She has said that American writers are lucky. They don't have to put up with such nonsense because they're protected by the First Amendment. I cannot imagine an American writer worrying or even thinking about being arrested or facing criminal charges for criticizing a religion or a government or an institution or a person. It is inconceivable. We may worry about offending someone. We may worry about creating a controversy. We may even worry about being sued in a civil court if we perhaps defame a real person. But the notion of facing criminal charges brought by the state is so remote and absurd that it is unreal. I have a good friend who lives in Rome, who is a writer and also a judge, and he's a great admirer of many aspects of our society and our culture. He loves America. Not everything, but a lot. He is very passionate about the First Amendment to our Constitution. He's told me many times, you guys in America, you American writers, can write about anything without fear of retaliation or intimidation from the state. And he says, do you know how lucky you are? And I always say, well, sure, I know how lucky we are, but I really don't think about it. We tend to take it for granted. It comes so natural to all of us. The freedom of speech, the freedom of speech and freedom of expression are so ingrained in our beings, in our culture, our society, our institutions, that we rarely stop and think about them. And we often take them for granted, which is another danger. Because of the purity and the simplicity of the First Amendment, and because it has been fiercely protected by the courts for over 200 years, I am able to write anything I want to write. I'm able to create dark, fiendish plots about lawyers and judges and politicians and big firms in Washington and without fear of anything happening. I'm able to criticize and ridicule and even satirize the FBI, the CIA, the Pentagon, Congress, the President. Because of the First Amendment, I'm able to create characters and stories and plots without giving a thought as to how far I can go. The beauty of the First Amendment is that its freedoms are virtually unlimited. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Many of you will recognize our keynote speaker today as the host of For the Record, the public affairs television program produced by the University of Virginia's Miller Center for Public Affairs and WHTJ PBS Charlottesville. She is also the weekly legal affairs commentator for National Public Radio's program Day to Day. But Dahlia Lithwick is most well known for her work as a writer for the online magazine Slate, as well as works appearing in numerous publications, including the New York Times and the New Republic. It gives me great pleasure to introduce that most radiant and elegant flower of summer, Dahlia Lithwick.
Good morning. It's a tremendous honor. I'm standing on my toes, by the way, so I don't have to move the microphone. It's a tremendous honor and privilege to look out and see all of you here on this glorious day to commemorate this astonishing monument. And I'm honored to have been asked to speak to you. We're here to celebrate and to honor the notion of free speech today. But I thought I'd take a moment and recognize its much misunderstood, often ignored cousin, free listening. Because it's perhaps the most under-recognized right that we have. It's uncodified, it's unenforceable, but it's a crucial component of the right to speak. And I fear sometimes it's on its last gasp. As Mr. Grisham just said, we have unprecedented freedom to write, to speak, to protest, to talk, to organize in this country. But with that right, there comes a responsibility to listen, to hear what others are saying, to converse, to have discourse and dialogue and debate. Without listening, there is no free speech. When the framers thought about what it meant to have a First Amendment, to have free speech and the free exchange of ideas, they thought of it in terms of a marketplace of ideas. A marketplace meaning that you and I, nose to nose, in the village square, my apple cart, your apple cart, and we yell at each other until someone is persuaded or someone backs down, but everybody is listening. I think perhaps the framers would be astonished to know that the marketplace of ideas morphed into a strip mall of ideas, which morphed into a five-floor megaplex, glass-enclosed, airless super center of ideas in which we don't listen to each other anymore because control of the media by red states or blue states, the notion that ideas and opinion have blurred with facts in our media, mean essentially that you can wake up in the morning, turn on AM radio, go to work, surf 50 websites, go home, turn on cable news, and never once encounter an idea that conflicts with your original ideas that day. We are in peril, ladies and gentlemen, of becoming the best read, ignorant people in the history of America. The idea of a marketplace of ideas is not a hall of mirrors. It is not to enter the world of the media and information and only reinforce what you already believe to be true. Free speech is not an end in itself, and we forget that sometimes. Free speech is a means to a larger end, making us a smarter polity, making our democracy thrive, challenging our own ideas with other people's ideas. And I fear that if we do not listen, if we come to believe that free speech ends at running your mouth all day, or ends at listening to other people who agree with you running your mouth all day, then the very freedoms that we try to protect with free speech are indeed in peril. There's a quote that's been variously attributed to two great legal thinkers. One is the former Chief Justice of the United States, Warren Burger. The other is Bob Marley. If you Google it, both appear almost as frequently. But the quote is this: free speech comes with the freedom to listen. And I'd urge that it also comes with the obligation to listen, not just to people who agree with you, but with people with whom you fiercely disagree. Don't mistake this for a plea for conventional civility. If this board is filled with flowers and sonnets and yes, indeed, we will have failed to do what we strive to do. But a plea for listening is not the same as a plea for civility. And I agree with Mayor Brown. There has never been a time in our history, and I say this both as a journalist and as a mother of two young boys, there has never been a time in our history where there was a greater need for outrage and outrageousness. But with that, there must come listening. There must come dialogue. There must come discourse. And so what I am asking you to do as you approach this wall in the coming days and months and years is to retract the idea that you have learned from cable news, that you have learned from AM radio, that discourse means shut up, you're an idiot. That is not political discourse. That is not the exchange of ideas. I ask you to back away from the notions that we have internalized from listening to too many angry pundits and too much AM radio, too many bloggers who are filled with hate and the impulse to swift boat each other. Retreat from the notion that anyone who disagrees with you is a moron. Retreat from the idea that anyone who disagrees with you is uninformed. Retreat from the idea that anyone who disagrees with you is either too close to God or too far from God to see straight. And acknowledge, as the framers did, that reasonable minds can differ. My friend Soren Kierkegaard once said, or was it Bob Marley? No, it was Kierkegaard. I quote, "People demand the freedom of speech to make up for the freedom of thought which they avoid." I disagree. I disagree that we have to avoid the freedom of thought. The eyes of the world, the eyes of this country are on Charlottesville right now. They want to see if this experiment in unfettered freedom is going to descend to the sort of ad hominem, gratuitous, mudslinging, offensive, non-discourse that makes up the bulk of political discourse today. And I say, let's defy them. Let's show Mr. Kierkegaard a thing or two. And let's prove that we understand what the framers were trying to teach us, that the freedom to speak encompasses and relies upon the freedom to listen. I congratulate everyone at the Jefferson Center today. This is an extraordinary monument. Have a good day. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Dahlia. That was terrific. We have a couple of trustees of the Thomas Jefferson Center here today, and lucky for you, we're only going to have one of them speak. But I must introduce to you another one who is here from the West Coast, one of America's new generations of enormously talented filmmakers, a woman who did the horse racing scenes produced the horse racing scenes for Seabiscuit. I thought that was the best part of the movie. I know Tobey Maguire and the actors wouldn't like to hear that, but she did. And last year, her film company, Mockingbird Pictures, produced the award-winning movie Nine Lives, which is just out in DVD. And if you haven't seen it, you've got to see it. Julie Lynn, please stand up. Now for the other trustee. You may know him better as an accomplished violinist and member of the acclaimed Grammy Award-winning Dave Matthews Band. But he is, in addition, a huge citizen like John Grisham of Charlottesville and active in a number of civic and cultural programs here. This morning, with a tie, Boyd Tinsley.
John, not so much that I'm so cool, but it is kind of hot today. This is for you. Thank you all very much. It's a great honor to be here today as a musician and as a member of the Board of Trustees. The First Amendment, especially as it pertains to free speech, I believe is one of the cornerstones of what it means to be an American and what it means to be free. I think that it is such a bedrock principle of our way of life that it's easy for us to take it for granted. I think that's why this dedication of this monument to free speech is such an important event. For one, because it is an everyday reminder of our constitutional right to express our ideas and opinions without fear of prosecution by the government. And I think it is very fitting that such a monument is erected here in Charlottesville, the home of one of the authors of the Bill of Rights, Thomas Jefferson. As a musician, I cherish the right that the First Amendment allows for true creative freedom. It allows the freedom to write and play music that sometimes challenges the political and social status quo. Where would we be without the lyrics of Bob Dylan during the 60s that helped us through that turbulent time? His lyrics reflected the world that we lived in. And whether or not you agreed with them, they forced us to think, to debate, and to reflect in a way that music touches us, not just intellectually, but in the heart. We must always be vigilant against attempts to infringe upon our right to free speech, whether in music or in everyday life. There have been attempts in the past, and they continue to this day. We have this great right enshrined in the First Amendment, but it is meaningless unless we as Americans exercise it and stand up to attempts to take it away. Thank you very much. And now it gives me a great pleasure to introduce a member of the Music Resource Center, a senior at Charlottesville High School, Brandon Dudley, who's going to come up and perform a song for us. Thank you.
We need some of those lyrics right up there on the chalkboard. The name of the Community Chalkboard and Podium is especially appropriate because this monument would not have been possible but for the efforts of literally hundreds of members of the Charlottesville community. On behalf of the Thomas Jefferson Center, I would like to thank the dozens of people who have volunteered and continue to volunteer their time to serve on the monument's advisory committee. To the 50 local artists who donated works that were auctioned as part of our fundraising campaign, to members past and present of the Charlottesville City Council and Board of Architectural Review, to the hundreds of you who donated money both for the construction of the monument and for other purposes, to all the people involved in the monument's design and construction, and of course to Pete O'Shea and Robert Winstead, the two local architects who designed this moment and monument to the First Amendment. But while our fingers are itching to use the chalk, and we're almost there, this monument would not have been possible without the energy and the constancy and the persistence of our director of the Thomas Jefferson Center, Bob O'Neill, and his deputy director, Josh Wheeler, and we thank them. And with that, I'm going to thank you all for being here on this glorious day and turn the podium back over to Bob O'Neill.
Thank you, Bruce, for guiding us through what has thus far been an absolutely flawless program. But even in the best of times, it was probably inevitable that there would be one possible glitch. So let me share it with you as we close the program. For some months now, we have promised those who were concerned about possibly objectionable material appearing on the chalkboard, we said, no, we will erase it once a week, every Thursday. This is Thursday. Here is our dilemma. Must we, consistent with our commitment to the city, Mr. Mayor, must we erase it tonight?
No.
Thank you. I thank you for your approval. I take that as a command that we will leave everything that goes up today until next Thursday, when the eraser will first fall. So, as the finale to the program, let me invite all of the speakers to come up and be the first to inscribe their thoughts on the chalkboard, after which we invite all the rest of you to come up, and assuming that the chalk hasn't run out by that time, we invite you to add your thoughts in making the chalkboard a reality. Thank you all for coming. Please join us at the chalkboard.
We got the first comment. You're on.
We got chalk.
After the program ended, all of the speakers were given chalk and asked to write the first few words on the chalkboard. Within minutes, the crowd of about 300 people gathered around the chalkboard's walls. These middle school students were kind enough to narrate for us.
Close Guantanamo. Remember the troops. Is the war in Iraq worth all the oil we will never get? Vote May 2nd for Tal, Fair, and North.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob
and
Josh.
I then asked some of the speakers to tell me what they wrote first, beginning with Dahlia Lithwick.
I wrote Close Guantanamo.
And then Mayor David Brown.
I encourage people to come vote on May 2nd for Dave Norris and Julian Taliaferro for City Council.
Well, that's free speech, isn't it?
That is.
Well, it's is that surprising, you think, that a politician would
write something overtly political? No, I don't think it's too surprising.
And then Bruce Sanford.
I wrote, thank you, Bob O'Neill and Josh Wheeler, our director of the Thomas Jefferson Center, because they are really the architects of this project.
Now let's get some reaction from some of the many people assembled.
I'm Ned Mickey, Charlottesville resident. It's a, I think the wall is beautiful in most ways. I think that the mild disappointment I have in it is that the gaps in the rocks are kind of rough, so it's a little hard to write on. But I think it's a very interesting idea, and I think it's going to work out fine.
What I see is this extraordinary nerve center of free expression and people just spontaneously coming up and writing what they want to see. I brought a poem that was echoed by George Garrett when he spoke. He picked the same quote. I thought, well, shall I say it again? And then I wrote it up there, and it was amazing. Mm-hmm. Absolutely amazing to feel that you were reaching the walking people in the street and the center of Charlottesville in some way. So there you go.
Well, I see two kids down at the bottom drawing pictures and writing. And above that, I see our forefathers died to give us this right. Do we have the courage to use it? Pick up the chalk. Remember the troops? In contrast to, is the war in Iraq worth all the oil we will never get? Right next to it. So I think that's interesting contrast.
I'm going to run out of room. I'm going to have to like do a little arrow.
Oh, I'm not in
the
room.
Oh, I'm sorry. Right. I ran out of room, too.
That's okay.
I think it's wonderful. Eventually, of course, there will be some obscenities and hate speech, I guess. But for the most of it, it's pretty good. Some good ideas. And I see somebody's putting down vote for so-and-so and vote for so-and-so. And a few comments, I guess, will be inane, you know. And I put a quotation of Winston Churchill on the other side. But I think it's a wonderful idea. And it'll give you something to do to come down. You have nothing to come over and read the board, you know. I really think it's a good idea. Yeah. So.
Why did you pick a quote from Winston Churchill, and which quote
he's,
was it?
He's one of my heroes. I'm not sure if I got it correctly. Never, 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 never give up or give in, give up. And I just, you know, I paraphrased that. I wasn't sure, but he's one of my heroes, you know. And I bet you I'll put some other quotes. Somebody quoted Edmund Burke, you know, the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men do nothing, but he misquoted it. The words have changed a little bit, you know. I hate to be pedantic about it, but so anyway, yeah, I think it's a very good idea, and I would imagine this will get national press. Yeah.
And your name is?
Patrick Fogarty.
The last person I spoke with was Rob Winstead, the chalkboard's co-designer.
I think it's exactly what we hoped it would be. There's obviously, you know, a great spirit and excitement about having this new element to our civic life in Charlottesville, and I think the things that were said today and the things that are written on the wall are exactly the kind of thing that we expect. As the culture of the wall develops, what we expect to see more of. And so I'm really hopeful about what's going on today. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I thought long and hard about what my first piece on the wall would be, but I'm going to hopefully have lots more to say in the future.
What was the first thing that you
wrote? The first thing that I wrote was that our forefathers died to give us this right. Do we have the courage to use it? And then I wrote under it, pick up the chalk. So hopefully people take that to heart and make good use of the monument.
The community chalkboard is open to anyone's comments 7 days a week. The walls will be erased every Thursday, with a special exception made for its opening day. Reporting for the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Sean Tubbs. CPN is supported in part by the Daily Progress. Check out dailyprogress.com for more coverage of the community chalkboard. For more information on the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, visit our website at sevillepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.